not necessarily the last stage of it. Not exactly either a large plasticine Jerry Ramone. But nevertheless, have you been inspired by... We mentioned H.G. Wells there, of course, wrote a great deal about science. We've been talking about Shelley. Is there any point where you find in fictional works an inspiration for real scientific ideas?
No. I used to read a lot of fiction, and I read very little fiction now, but scientists don't come well out of fiction, do they? I'd quite like to read this earlier version of Frankenstein now that you've put it in my mind.
But it's like in the movies, isn't it, that when the scientists are goodies, they're always saints. Like Marie Curie or Edison the Man and all these things. And there's no scientist in the middle. They're either demons or saints. And this middle area where it's rather boring and you're filling in research applications, you don't get films about that.
Yeah, I think I used to read things like Jim Watson's Double Helix. Those were the real inspirations to go into science. Yeah. And they were coming from scientists, really.
You are actually working in the lab genuinely on working out the idea of what creates life.
I am actually the modern Frankenstein, yes. I'm trying to create life in the lab, but rather than trying to reanimate a body, I'm trying to do it from scratch and just start with molecules. And, we've just got more molecules so far. That's all we've got. So.
But perhaps you could describe the experimental setup you've got. So it's at UCL, isn't it?
Yeah, so in a way it's similar because we're trying to use electricity. And the idea of reanimating a creature by some immediate electrical shock, which somehow then brings it to life permanently. Well, that's not really how life works. And, you give it electric shock, it's going to move its arms, but it's not going to continue moving around except as some kind of a zombie. What we actually have inside us is a continuous electrical current, which is coming from burning food in oxygen. And we're breathing all the time, and that's where it's coming from. And that's at a microscopic level. But curiously enough, the actual charge on the membranes of the cells that's keeping us alive is equivalent to a bolt of lightning. If you shrink yourself down to the size of a molecule, it's that kind of size of charge. It's 30 million volts per meter. So that's the kind of charges that you find in hydrothermal vents down at the bottom of the ocean on that same kind of scale. And that's the kind of environment where we think that life might have started. So the question is, can that kind of natural electrical charge in a hydrothermal vent, animate inorganic molecules into organic molecules that have particular shapes and structures and behaviour that start to grow and divide and so on. So that's the question, and it really is a kind of Frankenstein question. Yeah. But
it's really interesting because a couple of nights before Mary Godwin told the story of Frankenstein, 200 years ago, Shelley and Barham were discussing exactly that, a thing called the vitalist controversy, which is where does the original spark of life come from? And the controversy was between a chap called Lawrence, who said that, the spark basically came from biology. It's a sort of biological process. Versus a man called Abernethy, who said the spark came from God. And it was the Richard Dawkins controversy of its day. What kick-started life originally? Was it God or was it biology? And they were actually discussing that two nights before. And obviously Mary Godwin was listening to this conversation. She says so. And she went away and started writing Frankenstein. Yeah, so it's dead on for your work, actually.
Lawrence was, but he was even more violent than Richard Dawkins in his language, wasn't he? He said he wanted a description of life that was devoid of absurd fables and intellectual mist.
Yeah.
But that sounds like straight Dawkins.
But it's interesting at that time, because we're talking about the turn of the 19th century. So was that, was it a live debate then? Because it seems almost too early to have a very violent sort of a standoff between science and religion. That seems like a 20th or 21st century.
I mean, in the 18th century, in the Enlightenment, there's a lot of discussion about, are we just soft machines? Was God a sort of clockmaker who sets the machine in motion? We're meat puppets. And so lots of automata get made as an experiment to see whether you can actually make a facsimile of human behavior by mechanical means. A book came out called L'Homme Machine, Man a Machine. And so they don't quite know how to express it, and the vocabulary isn't there. But it's really in the ether, this idea of God or biology, in the early 19th century.
And it goes to the heart of ideas of the soul, I suppose. Is there some sort of supernatural animating force, or is it, I suppose electricity is the natural place to look at that time. It's a new phenomenon.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that Lawrence, the man who lost his professorship at the Royal College of Surgeons as a result of that lecture, was actually Shelley's doctor. And prescribed for his nervous headaches, and which he had a lot of, and things like that. So they had a direct connection with this debate, and that's what they were talking about. So Frankenstein at some level is puzzling out where does the vital spark come from. And you know, in the movies, you always get a whole reel of the operation scene, you know, the creation scene with, you know, lots of voltaic batteries and lightning and all this sort of thing. In the book, she just says, I gathered the instruments of life around me that I might infuse the spark of life into this lifeless being. That's all she says, full stop. Yeah. You don't have to worry about that in fiction. You do in the movies. And so that's not what it was about, the practicalities of it. It was the philosophical conundrum of where does the vital spark come from.
I mean, just the word vital spark implies that it's singular. It's like that. You give the spark and then you're living. And I think maybe what we've learnt since then is that it's not a vital spark, but it's still electrical. It's just, it's living is that continuous flowing of electricity in the body. There's not a spark that sets it off and it keeps going. It's just doing it all the time.
Noel, I was wondering on the on the physics of this.
Plasticine again.
No, not yet, but there will be a moment. I want you to go down to a hydrothermal vent and see if you can make all the Ramones. The thing that I find interesting is that especially the film versions of Frankenstein, which is, rather than just go, I'll get one body and then start it up again, for some reason he basically goes, I know, I'll get lots of bits, basically the equivalent, as far as I can see, of getting a clock, smashing it with a hammer, then smashing loads of other clocks with hammers, and then managing to glue them together to make a not quite so good clock and going, I must be a genius.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if you see any flaws in that method.
But just, there was a bit in Frankenstein, I haven't read it for a long time, but they sort of made the creature bigger because it was easier, because it was quite difficult to recreate the body and the organs and stuff, so they've made like a bigger version.
Yeah, he's 8 foot tall.
Right, 8 foot, yeah.
But you know, I think when Frankenstein describes where he gets his bits from, he says charnel houses, graveyards and slaughterhouses.
Right, so
there's
bits
of animal
bits
in there, as well as human, which is why he's larger than life. And the movies haven't really dealt with that. There's bits of animal inside.
Well, that's
him.
What I did. I used plasticine and Themo and some modelling clay.
Just a little bit of Play-Doh for the hair.
And some bits of that cat you had at university.
The thing is about it is I think that maybe she just skimmed over the scientific part because she didn't really know. She just went, and then I got some pieces of life and the eternal spark, gone. And then, because, you know, sometimes when you've got something quite conceptual, quite big, a concept, maybe it's easier to just be very simple about it and not elaborate or go into any detail, because then you can, someone can say, well, that's not true.
She's quite aware, Galvani had been doing experiments with electricity, electric shocks, twitching frogs' legs, I think they called it.
With the human
and
Aldini
was doing the human beings. Foster, he was electrocuting the heads of corpses and things, and even the eyes would open, all kinds of muscular twitches. Managed to get someone to stand up and his legs shot out or something. So all this was going on in that 20, 30 years before.
She was young, wasn't she, when she...
Yeah. She was 18.
18, yeah.
Well, she'd been. Was she at the where Aldini tried to reanimate the corpse? He'd just been hung,
yes,
hadn't he?
She wasn't present. We think she heard about it. She wasn't present. She went to Humphrey Davy's lectures, and she certainly knew about galvanism, but I don't think she was actually there when this man Forster, who'd just been hung, was sort of reanimated by the application of a voltaic battery.
It was reviewed in the Newgate Advertiser. So Aldini's attempt to reanimate this man, George Foster, he'd been hung for a murder, and they got him straight off the gallows and took him straight to the theatre.
So they knew even then that you had to get someone in pretty quick if you wanted to have any chance of reanimating them. You'd better do it within an hour or two, otherwise it wouldn't work.
And the description of his eye opening, popping open, is very similar to Mary Shelley's description of the creature when his eye opens, and there's something odd about his
would
eye.
Would he have been free to go after that, or would he have?
I love it. We looked at it twice, because it hurts more the second time.
The review at the end of it, in the paper the next day, said vitality might have been fully restored if many ulterior circumstances had not rendered this inappropriate. So it was quite remarkable that they thought if he'd carried on, that he might have got up, and then I suppose the question arises, what do you do with him? He's a convicted murderer. Did you go free, or do you put him back in jail?
Nick, just on the science of the creature or the monster, in terms of stitching together loads of different bodies, what would be the medical ramifications and problems? Because I presume you'd basically have the elbow rejecting the wrist and then the hand rejected by the... So it is going to be... Because I'm thinking of stopping with the research I've got to so far. But what... In terms of that, just looking at when you sometimes do examination of the pure science of what this would actually mean. So there we go. You have a body, you have a head stitched on, and then with a different brain put into it, you've somehow managed to connect. What problems are going to arise?
Good question.
He's making notes now for the radio listeners. Yeah. Robin is taking it down very carefully. He's got a diagram and everything. He's going to go home to wherever
he lives. I suppose
the
biggest problem is that all the bits would be to differing degrees dead. And, you know, some cells will be alive, some cells will be dead. Assuming that you were able to put them together perfectly, so all the nerves you could join them up, all the blood vessels you could join them up, and that, yes, you can start the heart beating again by electrocuting it or something, what would go wrong then? The biggest thing which is probably going to go wrong is exactly the problem with how do you get the electricity flowing again. So this is what goes wrong when you do an organ transplant today. If you take an organ out, you put it on ice for a couple of days, you try and find someone who's got the right immunological match so that it's not going to reject, and then you put it in again. And the problem that you have is that it usually fails at that point. If you've stored it for more than a day or two, on ice this is... then it all goes wrong. And it goes wrong as soon as you reintroduce oxygen. And what seems to be happening is, in effect, that the flow of electrons to oxygen just screws up. It will not get to oxygen properly. You produce these reactive free radicals. They attack the cell around it. And it breaks down kind of cell by cell from within. And to prevent that from happening is really, really difficult. I spent, you know, several years trying to do exactly that, and I got absolutely nowhere with it.
So when Aldini had an executed criminal who was only an hour old, his corpse, he was doing the right thing.
Well, I mean, that's essentially what we're doing if you restart someone's heart by applying electrical charge. So, I mean, it's possible in principle to do it. In practice, an hour, if you put it on ice, then you might have got a couple of days. If you have it not on ice, then an hour is pretty much as long as you've got, if that.
Yeah, and Christian and Barnard, when he did the very first heart transplant, in the press conference, said, "I felt like Frankenstein."
Yeah.
Given that we, as you've said, reanimating the machinery, which is already extremely complex, is extremely difficult. What do we know about the origin of life, the original spark of life? Because assuming it began on Earth, that means that the Earth went from a non-living thing, geology essentially, to biology somewhere.
So last time I was on this show, at some point I used the word proton gradients, and they all burst out laughing because they knew it was going to come fairly soon. But what's going on inside us, I've been talking about the architecture, we have mitochondria. These are the power packs of cells which are producing all the electricity. This is where you've got this electrical charge, equivalent to a bolt of lightning, across a very, very thin membrane. So 0.005 millimeter thick is a membrane. And you've got this enormous electrical charge across it. And we have something in the order of, you know, perhaps 1,000 mitochondria in every cell. So that means about 150 trillion mitochondria in your body covering a surface area with this charge of about 4 football pitches, and that's what's keeping us alive, and it's that continuous flow. So what's happening is we've got an electrical current with electrons coming from food and going to oxygen, and that current is powering the extrusion of protons across the membrane. Protons are the nuclei of hydrogen atoms, and that gives a charge across the membrane, and it's that which is keeping us alive. And so the question is, well, where on earth did a system as complex and as strange as that come from? And the interesting thing about the vents that I mentioned earlier is that they are, it's like a labyrinth of micropores. Each of these pores they're a bit bigger than cells as we know them, but not that much bigger. And they've got very thin walls around them. And across those walls, you have a natural proton gradient. So one side, you've got lots of protons, the other side, very few. It gives you a natural electrical charge across natural barriers. And so you've got from the very beginning, potentially, a system which is capable of kind of, as they say, evolve at this point, but developing step by step, potentially producing organics across those barriers and so on, and gradually becoming a cell with the same basic structure and the same same electrical basis.
You hesitate to say evolve because you need,
DNA. Until you have genes, but you've got to get to quite a level of complexity in chemistry. I mean, this is the real challenge at the origin of life, is how do you start out with carbon dioxide and hydrogen and end up with DNA or at least proteins or something like that, because you don't have natural selection until you've got that. So there's a long distance to cross, which is basically chemistry, and something's got to drive that chemistry in the right direction. And I think the thing which is driving that chemistry is electricity. A single shot.
But what I think all this shows is that in the era of genetic engineering, AI, and proton gradients, etc., that Frankenstein has become the real creation myth. No longer Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, but across the world, the real creation myth in terms of intervening in these processes is now Frankenstein. There you are. There's a thought.
What do you make of those? So the theories, let's say that life began in vents. Would you have a preference? What would you like your ancestor to be? Would you like it to be a hydrothermal vent below an ocean 4 billion years ago, or something more romantic?
And you don't have to invite this relative to the wedding, by the way, if you're thinking something slightly
more romantic might be ideal.
This is one of my oldest relatives. It's a rock with some proton gradients in it.
They might get a bit drunk later and do some embarrassing dancing, but ignore them.
So we asked the audience a question, and that question today was, if you were making a monster, whose body parts would you find particularly useful? And we did also say, please remember, this goes out on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Nevertheless, we still have quite a few involving Brian. Look, it doesn't matter. So let's...
Alan Bennett's vocal cords. Then, at least, when the monster went on its murderous rampage, the corresponding monologue would be charming and twee.
That is lovely, isn't it?
We belong dead, because I was looking behind the sofa and I found the fingers of a golem.
Brian Cox and Brian Blessed! My monster will have perfect hair and a perfect beard. That would be a fascinating thing. See, it would be fine if it was you and Brian, like Blessed's voice, but the other way round is really weird. Imagine big Brian Blessed going, and the wonderful thing is... Gordon is alive.
Or dead. In fact, he's in a superposition.
Superposition. Yeah. The Jean-Luc Picard, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. My monster will boldly go where no one has been before, but will be able to make a U-turn at a moment's notice and then frightening enough to scare the wits out of anyone. That's a really weird mix, because now I'm imagining Jean-Luc Picard with Donald Trump's hair, which is not... That could be very easily sorted out, I imagine. And we'll just find out the manufacturer. So thank you very much to our guests, who have been Professor Nick Lanes, Christopher Frayling, and Noel Fielding! And we leave you with a quote from Mary Shelley's introduction to Frankenstein, which is, "And now, once again, I bid my hideous progeny to go forth and prosper." So, thanks very much, hideous progeny. We'll see you again at some point. And thank you, Brian. Not hideous progeny, lest you see the truth, what lurks beneath this Stepford physicist. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
In the infinite monkey cage.
Now nice again.
Thank you. This is the Blue Dot Festival, and this is the Infinite Monkey Cage. This is the first time for quite a while that Radio 4 have done a panel show in an open field.
Not a...
How many of you have actually been to Jodrell Bank before? Isn't the Lovell Telescope one of the most beautiful pieces of human imagination turned into a structure to interrogate the universe that you've seen recently? Yeah! We actually stood in the right in the middle of the dish, didn't we? What was it, about six months ago?
Yeah, for our Einstein program.
We did it. It was great. We did this program about Einstein, and afterwards we're sitting in the canteen, and I asked Brian to explain a little bit more about general relativity, and he did it very beautifully. And someone had gone to go and get him a pie, because that's how famous he is. He doesn't have to get his own pies, they are brought to him. And he leant forward, still smiling, bit into the pie and went, ow, 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 it's boiling, right? Which I thought was very beautiful, because there's something wonderful about seeing a human being who understands the idea of the heat death of the universe, but not the speed of the cooling of a pie. So it was great, though. It is such a beautiful structure.
It is a beautiful structure. The fact that it can see out to the edge of the observable universe, as we talk about, 13 billion light years away, it's a tremendous thing. I'm not going to give it away, though.
That is, what we're going to be talking about is what we are yet to find out about the universe, what we still need to know about the universe. So the official title is The Universe, What Remains to be Discovered, brackets, not dark energy or dark matter, close brackets.
Because fans of Monkey Cage will know we've done that about six times, and so our producer said we're not allowed to talk about dark matter and dark energy. Dark matter is 70% of the energy density in the universe. Dark energy is 70%. Dark matter, yeah?
Do not tell anyone you saw that! It's the most secret thing! Oh, my God!
What a brilliantly knowledgeable crowd this is. Dark matter, 25%. So we've got about 4.9% of the universe that we're restricted to talk about, but we'll make a good...
There's another reason we're not going to talk about dark energy, because even after every show we've done about dark energy, people have gone, well, what exactly is dark energy? And you've gone, it's a little tricky, that one. It's a little tricky. So we have a great group of people. Again, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Associate Director of Jodrell Bank, Tim O'Brien, astronomer Paul Abel, actor and author Ben Miller, and singer and songwriter Charlotte Church. And we're going to open with Hotel California. So, Paul,
we look like some horrendous Boyzone tribute act.
So we will get... This is, as I said, it is quite a bizarre thing. We've never done this. We are doing it properly, well, as properly as we've ever done it, but as it's going to be a discussion about what we have yet to find out about the universe. And so we'll start off... Well, in fact, talk about the music that you heard when we came on is a fantastic recent piece of music called Hello Moon, but it is not merely music. And Tim O'Brien, I want to ask you, tell me a little bit more about why an audience here at Jodrell Bank in the shadow of the Lovell Telescope, why they should be fascinated by what they heard as we walked on.
Because somewhat bizarrely, maybe, that dance track is made up of a remix of space sounds, some of them recorded with this telescope. So the beat, the thud, 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 thud that you hear is actually the thud of pulsars, the flash of stars that exploded thousands of years ago. They spin like cosmic lighthouses hundreds of light years away, and we detect the flashes with the telescope, take those radio flashes and turn them into a sound. And that sound gives that rhythm that we then built into that dance track. So
should perhaps describe pulsars in more detail, because they're fascinating objects in their own right.
They're about the sort of mass of the sun, so about 1.5 times mass of the sun, but only about the size of a city, so only about 20 kilometres across. So if you can imagine getting a giant pair of oven gloves or something and getting hold of the sun and squashing it down to the size of a city, that's a pulsar.
Mass of the sun, 20 miles across or so, rotating how fast?
Well, some of them rotate, the fastest ones rotate more than 700 times a second. So it's something that the mass of the sun, the size of a city, spinning more than 700 times a second, radiating out sort of beams of radio waves from the magnetic poles, and as those beams sweep round, just like a lighthouse, you get a flash, 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 flash.
And if we look at the Lovell telescope over there, how distant are the pulsars that you can listen to?
They range from a few tens of light years away to several thousand light years away. So the radio waves we're picking up with that telescope have taken, in some cases, thousands of years to reach us, travelling at the speed of light, 300,000 kilometres every single second.
Well, Ben, your most recent science book is about trying to define what life is, and indeed looking at it as well from the perspective of possible extraterrestrial life. Now, talking about pulsars, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, somebody initially what was called LGM1. And I wonder if you can give us a little bit of background of why a pulsar may have been given the tag LGM1.
Yes, well, this is a brilliant story, dating back to a time when we were first switching on our radio telescopes and starting to look at the sky. And, of course, we just didn't know really what we might find. And one of the possibilities was a signal from an alien civilization. What if there was an alien civilization out there with radio telescopes broadcasting some kind of signal? So I think this was something that all radio astronomers of the time were aware of. And Jocelyn Bell Burnell, as you say, set up a radio telescope about 1967. She was doing her PhD, actually, and she was looking for a special type of a very active galaxy called a quasar. She built this very sensitive, for the time, radio telescope, and she was there at night, and she had the chart recorder paper, because there was no sort of electronic instrumentation. You know, it's just like a proper good old-fashioned chart recorder going along. And she began to notice, when she looked at the readout, there was about 2 centimetres of what she called scruff that appeared on the paper, which was this very, very intense signal. And, of course, then she lay in wait, and one night she managed to be there just at the right time to switch the chart recorder pen so that it could really pick up the detail of the signal. And it was a pulse, which is exactly what you might expect if an alien civilization had set up some kind of beacon, some kind of lighthouse, some kind of indication, here we are, come and have a chat. So they called this source LGM after Little Green Men. It was slightly tongue-in-cheek, I believe, at the time. But there was a very real possibility. And Jocelyn Bell Burnell was furious because she needed to get a PhD out of setting up this experiment. And she felt absolutely gutted because some alien civilization had decided to signal to her at exactly the frequency she was looking at and ruined her experiment.
But I remember we do a Stargazing Live here, as some of you might know, and we had about 3 or 4 years ago now, wasn't it, when we discovered a planet in the Kepler Space Telescope data, and we asked Tim, we were all sat there going, it'd be brilliant if someone had a radio telescope. Tim said, yeah, okay. So we swung it around to this planet, and then at some point, the BBC said, what happens if we detect a signal? In where? In the broadcasting regulation. Does it say we're allowed to do it? So, we asked Tim.
We had to look at what to do. Yeah.
What would a radio astronomer do? What would you do? You're director of this telescope. If you heard a signal, would you immediately go on Twitter and go, there are aliens out there?
Okay. Probably.
Officially.
In fact, we would want people to know, right? So we would not keep it secret. I mean, people think somehow we've signed some official secrets act that says if you detect aliens, don't tell anybody, there'll be mass panic. We haven't done that. Nobody here has signed that. We would want people to know because it'd be the most incredible thing we'd ever discovered. But what you would do first, actually, is check you got it right. Yeah. So you would actually think about it in the same way that the people at Cambridge, Jocelyn and Tony Hewish, but those people, they looked at it and they thought, they did name it that, but they thought, you know, is it really aliens? And they thought about it for months, and they kept it quiet for months because they wanted to check what was going on. So there'd be a period of checking. You'd get your mate with another telescope to have a look, see whether they could see it. I had somebody else ask me this question quite recently, what would we do? And it's not really written down. So we'd be inventing it as we went along, to be honest, and we'd say, okay, well, is it real? We'll go to the International Astronomical Union. We'll tell the union and see what they think.
It's an amazing thing. There's no protocol. You would think. I think we looked, and the only people we could find who had a protocol were Vatican City. Sure. But they had some regulation, didn't they? You ring the Pope.
So I don't know whether it's comforting or not that we don't have a protocol for what to do if we pick up aliens. Oh. Is it comforting? So what people think.
The idea that if you had broadcast that on Stargazing, that the second signal you get from extraterrestrial life would be a cease and desist letter being sued for they've invaded our privacy on Andromeda.
Yeah, or something like going, that Darrow Green's always on.
Yeah. Charlotte, the very first time that we met was at another music festival, End of the Road, where at one point you were watching Sufjan Stevens and singing along, and someone turned to you and said, you've got a nice voice.
Yeah.
And you just said, thanks very much. And, but the first conversation we'd never met before is you kind of came up to me very quickly in a glittery outfit and just went, I love physics!
Yeah.
And You know, people know that obviously that you've been interested in such a broad thing. What was it about physics? What is it that drew you into kind of the world of things like cosmology?
Do you know what? It happened when I was at a newsagent's and I was buying some completely pointless, worthless celebrity beauty magazine thing. And I saw a copy of The New Scientist and I thought, what am I doing? Why am I, I want to have a go at that. And it sort of changed my life. And I just found it, I was absolutely fascinated by everything in it. And that sort of then just ignited my, you know, just this idea of learning about all of this stuff. And it was possible that, you know, I didn't have to be, you know, a proper boffin or, you know, have to go to university to be interested and be able to educate myself, you know, even a little about these massive concepts. But also I found like an immense amount of comfort, you know, especially when it comes to things like quantum mechanics and just how odd some things about our universe and reality and some of these huge ideas, these mind-bending ideas, I found loads of comfort in.
We should, Paul, because the main subject of this discussion is things we don't know.
Yes.
And that idea, quantum mechanics,
yeah,
the way that interacts, I suppose, with cosmology in the sense of relativity, that's one of the big things. Perhaps you could start just by giving the one-minute description why quantum mechanics and our best theory, the framework for cosmology, general relativity, doesn't fit together.
A big admission on behalf of all theoretical physicists in this area, we don't have a quantum theory of gravity. We do have quantum mechanics. It's brilliant. It's the reason why all your mobile phones work. We have general relativity, which is the reason why all your sat-navs work, and they got you here today on time. They both fundamentally disagree on the nature of space-time, and that's really rather embarrassing because it means you have to sort of choose whether you want to do physics of the very small or physics of the very large. And we don't want to have to do that. It's very, very embarrassing to have be in that situation. The reason why black holes are key to this is because around the event horizon of a black hole, we have quantum mechanical effects that are happening as well as gravity. The two have to work there. They have to coincide there. So this becomes a very good place to look for a quantum theory of gravity, how gravity works at quantum scales. And when people started doing this in the 70s, one of the most remarkable results that came out of this hybrid of the two theories, quantum field theory, was that black holes are not static, they're not dead, they radiate slowly over time. And the fact that the smaller the black hole is, the quicker it radiates. So far from being static, dead objects, any primordial black holes that may have formed at the time of the Big Bang might now be evaporating. And as they get smaller, the evaporation process runs away, and they explode in a shower of gamma rays. I mean, in cosmological terms, it's not that impressive, but if one went off in this field, it would be enough to take out us, the stage, and most of this side of the planet. So
actually,
a bit of respect for them. But these gamma ray bursts that exist out in the universe, we don't know if they could be the final death throes of black holes. I think I went over a minute, didn't I?
No. But Tim, gamma ray bursts, they're one of the big mysteries. So perhaps you could describe gamma ray bursts from an observational standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, these were things that were discovered in the late 60s. And they were actually discovered by satellites that were put up to look for people violating the test band, you know, testing atomic weapons. So they were seeing flashes of gamma rays, thinking that they were coming from the Earth. And in fact, it was a sort of pantomime, it's behind you moment, because they were behind the satellites out in the distant universe. So every so often, one of these things explodes, flash of gamma rays.
Yeah.
We had no idea what they were for decades. We still don't know exactly, but we do know they're far away. So they're scattered all over the sky. That means they're not in our Milky Way. They don't sort of track the Milky Way across the sky. They're all over, very distant, probably explosions. Mm. Our best guess is that they're explosions of massive stars, supermassive stars at the ends of the line.
By very far away, how far do you mean?
Oh, I mean many millions of light years, and in probably in most cases billions of light years. So when we look out in time, of course, in space, I should say, the great thing about astronomy is you're seeing back in time. Mm. So, you know, you've got like a telescope that's a time machine. You look far away, you see far back in time. So these things are back a good fraction of the age of the universe. So we're seeing billions of years into the past when these things are
exploding. Well, I want to quickly ask something. Because we were talking about the idea of looking back in time, we should also cover the notions of time and the debates over our understanding of how we believe we experience time.
Yes.
And then time as an idea within physics.
Time in physics is very interesting because we have sort of kind of like have two forms of it. So, and I think it's probably just me being stupid, but I've never really understood how time in quantum mechanics works. It's not really like time in general.
Can anybody help us? We should say, have you got the 1 minute version of what on earth you mean by that sentence? Yeah.
Time in general, I'm going to do it from the other way around. Time in general relativity is really well described. We know if you move quicker, time moves slower for you and for other people observing you. They have their own measurement of time. But I'm still not clear, really, what time is in quantum mechanics and how it all... I mean, we need time in there because it's what we call a unitary theory. Things happen A, B, C, D, but they have to be time reversible as well. That's another important point. So you have to be able to go back the other way. But we don't see those sort of processes happening on larger scales. So I... Ben, sorry.
Is it right to say that in both quantum mechanics and general relativity...
Yes.
There's nothing to stop you going back in time. I mean, there's nothing within the actual theory. Do you see what I mean? Aren't all processes time reversible?
No. It's actually closed time like geodesics are express. I shouldn't have said that. It's a bit too...
The answer is no. I'll try and do it. In special relativity, it's the fact the speed of light is a constant for all observers.
Yes.
Ultimately is the thing that stops you being able to go back in time. It's built into the geometry.
Because you then would reverse causality.
But you can't bend that geometry in curved space-time. So if you've got powerful gravity field, you can bend your future light cone into the past, but we think those space-time solutions are not stable. We don't think that it's real. Really, we just frown upon it and hope that there is no such thing.
Since nobody's arrived from the future, is that not a good practical... has anybody arrived from the future? I don't know.
His hand up. I got shouted at for saying that by a relativist because they said no, because it seems to be true that you can't go back further than the first time machine.
No. Well, it depends on quantum effects. Whose past are you going into? What do we really mean by past, present, and future? Because it's not clearly defined. And I've come to slowly believe through my brief foray into this area that our problems we're experiencing in finding a quantum theory of gravity lies with time. And I think maybe changing it or removing it, or at least some sort of alternative understanding...
Removing time.
That is what he
said. Don't say it like that, Ben. It's not weird.
Can he do that?
Now?
No, not now.
No, because you can't even define what now is.
Yeah, I guess that's...
Don't remove time. Underworld are on in 2 hours. It'd be a disaster. Charlotte, what was the moment when you were reading... Well, not just The New Scientist. Do you have kind of stop-start moments where you get to a certain idea and it becomes so delightful, for instance?
Well, I was reading something about the idea of the big bounce as opposed to the big bang, which literally made me, like, clap and whoop with joy. Amazing, and it's sort of so neat and lovely. And it was about the idea that, you know, at the point of singularity, there is zero mass, but infinite energy. And, you know, when that happens, then, you know, you've got, that's the end of, you know, general relativity. And so the idea of trying to circumvent how you get to avoid the singularity. And just reading, like, lots of different people's ideas of how you do that, it made me have a little...
vast universe that we look out to. I wanted to go back, actually, Ben, because you wrote a book recently on life in this vast cosmos.
Yes, well,
it must be the case there's life somewhere. But if we talk about civilization, the question I know Frank Drake, the astronomer, defines civilization as something capable of building a radio telescope. That was his definition, the sense that at least you could communicate. So what was your feeling? What position did you come to on the likelihood of us making contact with these telescopes, seeing another civilization?
Well, I think a bit like you, I feel that microbial life, bacterial life, that seems to kickstart itself. If life on Earth is anything to go by, and finally it's all we do have to go by at the moment, if that's any guide, it seems like that happened pretty quickly on Earth, and it seems like that's almost a property... I mean, to quote you, your ancestors are rock. You know, it's quite possibly volcanic vents on the seafloor of the very early Earth that produced the first cells. It feels like... that process, the harnessing of everyday chemical reactions into a life form, happens almost on a continuum. From as soon as you create a rocky planet with some sort of tectonic activity, you start to get that basic kind of life. The real question, and it's very, very hard to answer, I think, with the limited amount of information we have, is the leap from these almost two different kinds of very simple life that started, the archaea and the bacteria here on Earth, which then merged, it seems, in one single event from which every other complex organism then evolved. That only appears to have happened once. And so the question is, how rare is that event?
Tim, this is, in principle, an answerable question, isn't it? And SETI, using telescopes like the Lovell for SETI, was frowned upon for many years, whether it was seen as a fringe activity. Is it still, and do you do it here, and is it legitimate now?
So SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, often with radio telescopes. The problem, the reason you might say it might be frowned upon, is because you could spend your whole career using up all the time on radio telescopes like this one, searching for signals from aliens and never getting one, because we have no idea if aliens exist, we have no idea if they're sending us messages, and so that's why, in a way, it's frowned upon, because there's loads of other interesting stuff we could be doing with the telescopes. But actually, in fact, it's now part of the key science aims of many telescopes. So we have done SETI with this telescope. We did the thing called Project Phoenix, which we searched all the 1,000 nearby stars with a few telescopes around the world, including this one. We didn't pick anything up, otherwise we would have told you. The Square Kilometre Array, that's one of its science aims. It will do SETI. So although it'll do other stuff at the same time as well, it's got this clever system of being able to look at multiple things at once.
Charlotte, I wanted to just... How do you feel about the idea of sentient extraterrestrial creatures that may well even be superior to us? How do you think human beings, that first announcement, do we end up with that kind of Orson Welles moment of panic during the broadcast of War of the Worlds?
Yeah, definitely. I think everybody, people are pretty fearful on this planet right now, and I should imagine that if you throw that into the mix, then they might completely lose their minds entirely. I think it would be wonderful. I read something interesting out of Harvard. Some lady was saying that that she thought the most likely life on another planet that we'll ever discover won't be biological, because there are there are far fewer planets which could sustain biological life, that actually what you'd be looking at is far more like super intelligent robots, like AI, who could live in all different sorts of terrain, who would not, and the reason that they haven't contacted us is because they're so far advanced that they really don't care. They're totally disinterested in having a conversation.
So we're just like a sample on a slide from pond water.
Yeah, but I quite like the idea of super intelligent robots, but controlling the skies.
I think you've got your prog rock album waiting for you there, definitely.
It's funny, this festival's called the Blue Dot, isn't it, which reminds you of that famous sort of Carl Sagan passage where it was sort of seeing ourselves as a planet suspended in this, big empty galaxy that sort of really... made us reimagine ourselves as a species. I think when we see evidence of another living species out there in the furthest reaches of the galaxy, I think it would be a tremendously unifying thing for us, for very positive reasons, because we really have to think about what our aims are, what we're here for. And I think there's so much division in the world and in society at the moment. And I think we could really benefit from having some sort of protocol, having some kind of UN meeting, some subcommittee, where we decide what we represent and what we would like to communicate to alien civilizations out there. And basically tell them we want to leave Europe. Yeah.
Well, we're going to bring it to a close with something we didn't even get around to talking about, which was the Golden Record. And, of course, now it will be a golden iPod or USB, and that would all be required. But we were wondering what should be placed on the next Golden Record that will be sent on whatever might be the next Voyager. And Charlotte came up with an idea for what song she believed should be on that record. So... please welcome to the singing microphone, I believe, and also joined by her writing partner, someone she performs with a great deal, Johnny, as well. This is Charlotte's belief of what we should place on the next golden USB.
All right.
Set them alight, believe. walk my path, wear my shoes, talk like that, I'll be an angel in things. Can only get better, can only get better. Now I found you, things can only get better, can only get better. Now I found you.
Ready?
Charlotte Church and Johnny, that that was don't be like Stars in Your Eyes, because it turned out not everyone knows the song as well as they imagine.
I mean, these things are going to only get better.
Can I just say, I didn't know you were going to do that.
No, we did keep that quite quiet. The thank you very much, Blue Dot. We've had this is the first time we've done it in the open air in a field.
And thank you.
We have been very happy to have with us Paul Abel, Tim O'Brien, Ben Miller, Charlotte Church. That's the final show of this series. We'll be back at Christmas. Thank you, Blue Dots, and goodbye!
In the infinite monkey cage.
Turn out nice again.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and today's Infinite Monkey Cage comes from the Museum of Science and Industry in Manchester.
Now, on first look, today's subject looks like one of the few sciences that Brian is actually rubbish at, because we're looking at domestic science. And anyone here who has tried Brian's flapjacks will know they are extremely disappointing and overly dense. So, anyway, sadly tonight, it's not about that form of domestic science. The domestic science we're going to talk about will have no recipe hints apart from those which are directly linked to Archimedes, entropy, and electrons. So, back on safe ground, Brian Cox.
The objects you encounter in your home obey the same laws of physics as Higgs bosons, neutron stars, and lasers, and as such, they offer a deep insight into the fundamental workings of the natural world.
So, I'd like to take this opportunity to congratulate all of those who are listening who have a very messy house. Well done. You are allowing your house to evolve in accord with the second law of thermodynamics, whilst those mithering tidy uppers are pointlessly subverting the will of the laws of physics.
On the panel to discuss the laws of nature hidden in the everyday world, we are joined by...
Hello, my name is Danielle George from the University of Manchester. I'm a professor of radio frequency engineering, and my favourite bit of physics you'd find around the home is the toilet. Do you want me to elaborate?
Yes, you can elaborate.
Excellent. So if you think about principles of physics, potential energy, the buoyancy effect, pressure, these are all things that you'd find, conservation of energy, you'd all find these in the toilet. And it's something we take for granted every day. Mm.
So that's toilet physics, but let's move on to our next guest.
I'm Dr. Helen Cherovsky. I'm a physicist who works in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at UCL. And my favourite bit of physics in the everyday world is the coincidence that means I spill my tea every single day when I walk with it down the corridor from the tea room to my office.
And so are we going to talk about this a little bit later on, or do you want to explain that now?
So when you shake a cup of tea, it slops from side to side, and you will notice, or you will from now on, that the bigger the cup of tea, the slower the slopping is. Small cup of tea, very small, very fast slopping. And it just so happens that the rate at which you walk is exactly the slopping rate of the average cup of tea. And so what that means is it pushes the sloshing higher and higher, and then you spill your tea. So that little coincidence in the physics that your walking rate is the same as the sloshing rate of a mug is why it's so easy to spill tea when you're carrying it.
And our final guest is...
I'm Russell Kane, BA Honours English, Middlesex University. And Tottenham campus. And... I'm a comedian, apparently. That's what people always say afterwards. And my favourite bit of everyday physics is theta and delta wave manipulation and its nocturnal prevention of my existential equilibrium, which is the long way of saying putting my daughter on a sleep routine so I don't kill myself.
And this is our panel. Helen, I'm going to start with you because part of the reason we're doing this show is based around a book of yours that we read, which is looking at the physics which is around us in the everyday. And this is tea time when this is first going out. This is a moment where the Radio 4 listener is getting their homemade jam out. They are having a cup of tea. So as well as the effect of reverberation we've been talking about already, what are the other things that our tea-drinking, jam-eating Radio 4 listener, what can they observe at this moment in terms of the laws and actions of physics?
Well, the most obvious thing you see is that when you add milk to your tea or coffee and you see the two liquids mixing into each other, they don't just sort of merge, they swirl around each other. And that's actually quite... That's an important observation because you see something similar in the sky where warm and cold air are swirling around us, especially at these latitudes. We get these big rotating storms coming across the Atlantic towards us. And so that's actually really important that liquids don't mix just by joining into each other. They swirl around. So there's something, and you can see that pattern in lots of places in the world. And then you can play, this is a good one if you've got a teacup at home, to get a spoon and tap your teacup around the rim and you will hear that the pitch of the cup changes. I've got a teacup here. Because Radio 4, you know, there's always a teacup, right? It's one of the BBC rules. So I've got a spoon and I'm just going to, so there's two different notes going on as I'm tapping around the rim. And the reason for that is that, all objects in the world are basically musical instruments and what you're hearing is their structure. And when you hit it, the cup vibrates and it basically vibrates by, squishing, going rugby ball shaped. And then rugby ball shaped the other way. And it just so happens that one of those involves the handle moving and one of them doesn't. And the one that involves the handle moving, the cup is effectively heavier. It's got more inertia, and so it vibrates more slowly. So you can actually hear the extra mass of the handle as you're tapping the teacup around the rim.
Because you've now explained that, can you actually do that again then, just so they now hear that?
This is when I'm tapping exactly opposite the handle, so the handle has to move. And now I'm going to tap at 45 degrees to that so the handle won't move. So there's about a semitone difference in pitch, and it's just from the added mass of the handle. I can keep playing with teacups. That's probably enough for now.
I don't know. Anyone who just tuned in at that point are thinking they were on Radio 3 listening to the Andy Kershaw show, another session from the teacup players of Paraguay.
These ideas, the study of the way that liquids mix and the complex patterns that emerge during that mixing is actually, it's one of the I was going to say, I don't mean least understood areas of physics, but it's not fully understood by any means, is it? It is actually a very current research topic.
Yeah, so I think that there's this feeling that because it's in the everyday, it must be mundane and simple and just sort of, you know, trivial. And that is absolutely not true because there are these three frontiers in physics research. There's sort of quantum mechanics in the very small and there's general relativity in the very large and then there's the bit where they're trying to get them to join up around the back. And then there's the complexity of the everyday world, which is mostly, you know, Newton's laws of motion and simple thermodynamics and wave equations. But they interact in complex ways. You get simple rules, but they do quite complicated things when you set them going.
And also, Danielle, we're talking about the everyday scales, things you see in your house, but it translates, the same problems appear across the universe and back in time towards the origin of the universe. So it's the same physics.
Absolutely, yeah. So right from the cosmic microwave background, so the 3.8 billion years ago, universe exploded, the radiation there is all of that sort of complex nature there, then into star formation and how that's all changed from 3.8 billion years ago up to now as well. You see it all. But I think the really good thing for me with trying to put it into the sort of the everyday mundane things is if you can see it there, we have all these big challenges, these grand global challenges, and that could be sort of climate change or it could be looking into space or whatever it is. If people sort of look in their coffee cup and go, wow, okay, now I know that what's happening here is this, that, and the other, and they can explain it just by the everyday things that they see around them, they might be much more interested in then looking further and developing their knowledge further to solving these big grand challenges and these big space challenges that we face as well. So I think it has a two-way thing as well.
And they're the same fundamental laws of nature at work. So you're talking about patterns forming in coffee. It's probably more complex, actually, I suppose, in some sense, than stars forming in galaxies, or at least the same level of complexity.
It's certainly the same level. Yeah, I would say so, yeah. And again, it is all about patterns and about knowing how you know, where it goes, where it started from and where it's going as well, and trying to predict that pattern, trying to predict what happens in star formation or galaxies or the beginnings of the universe or where the universe is going as well.
Well, I wanted to get Russell in here because, yeah, as a comedian as well, one of the things is you are meant to try and maintain that childish ability to just go, but why, which is that wonderful, the natural thing which we, as the older we get, as you kind of mentioned, Helen, there's a moment where that's meant to become embarrassing, to be constantly inquisitive about the world. Do you think when you wander around your house, when you look at the behaviour of those things around you, have you still got that ability to be curious?
Yeah, I think I'm going backwards, if anything. Like, I ask why all the time. And one of the brilliant things about being in the building where we're recording this right now, the Museum of Science Industry, there's loads of naked machines where you can see inside them and see exactly how they work. Because what I'm finding is, as we go on, particularly sort of post-iPhone technology, the machines are getting more capable and more complex, but I've got less of a clue of how they work. So I think, this is because I've been swatting up on Helen's book, like a girly swat, there should be more see-through machines. Like, at least one of every major machine that makes our life work should be see-through. So there should be like a see-through iPhone. There should be a see-through a steam train, I think you use the example, or a see-through train in your book. Because the more stuff we have, the less we know how it works. Whereas if I was a Victorian, I'd be like, oh, I'd shovel some coal in, then go and visit my lady of the night, and I know where my top hat was stitched, and I'd come home again.
You sound like Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, well, I
shovel the coal, I'll see my lady of the night with my top hat. Finally revealed on a monkey case.
Say what you like about Jack the Ripper, he's very technologically aware. So that's why I ask why, because I don't like being given something brilliant and going, oh, this is the new so-and-so computer, it's so many megahertz because it's got an i6. And I'm like, what's an i6? It doesn't mean anything. What do you mean its internal processor does this? It's just a piece of plastic now. Whereas 100 years ago, I would have been able to see the satisfying cogs turning. And I think as human beings, if you're not trained as a physicist or a scientist, it's harder to translate what a machine's doing if you can't see bits turning and smashing against each other.
Danielle, you're a professor of engineering, and one of the challenges we have actually today is to inspire people to go into engineering. We have a shortage of engineers. Do you think there's a link between that idea that you don't see the engineering? I mean, when I was growing up, we had a valve television. I can mention valves. But you had TV repair people that would come in and repair the TV. You would have to put the valves in the early 70s. So you had access, and then people like me, when we were growing up, would build radios from electronic sets and things. So do you think there is a correlation between that completely invisible technology now in a modern cell phone, for example, and that the lack of, you can't see the workings?
Definitely, yeah, absolutely. But I think we've sort of started to come through that terrible era, and it's like the Dark Ages, because they are just all black boxes. You know, like you're saying, Russell, everything is just, you know, your iPhone or your tablets or whatever, they're black boxes. The manufacturers don't want you to get into them. Mm. Whereas, you know, when we were younger, it would be, let's get it open, let's tinker, let's see what it is, let's break it, let's fix it. And the manufacturers now don't really want you to do that. And so I think we've had this era, and we've seen it with students coming into university as well, where it is just the, well, it works, and if it doesn't, I'm just going to throw it away and get another one, a very sort of disposable society. But I think we're coming out of that now, and I think it's really good with the sort of the Raspberry Pis, the Arduinos, and all of these bits of electronics that do allow people to start building the radios of the future, start to do more like wireless technology. They can create their own systems in the house. They can add it to Minecraft if that's what they play on their PlayStation or whatever. And so I think we are coming through it, but it has had a really detrimental effect to engineering and manufacturing in this country, for sure.
Helen, you wanted to... Sorry.
Well, a couple of things. One of the things that gets lost, I think, in the age of touchscreens is the appreciation that anything's happening. Like, the appreciation for how much science and technology it takes to create that is getting lost. And the thing is, someone has to build the modern world. We still live in a physical world. We still have bodies that are about this size. We still live on a planet, which functions in the physical world. We still need materials to build things. So although the modern, you know, the things that computers allow are really important, we still need to understand physical materials and how to actually build things out of stuff, because we're still going to sit at tables that are about this height and sit on chairs that are about this height, I think it's really important that we don't lose that, because if we lose that, then we feel helpless.
How do you feel about that, Russell? I mean, you have a young child as well, and this kind of going into a new world where you will be looking at them playing with things that you probably don't understand at all. And is there a Luddite side to you, or she's one,
and already the floor can be covered with toys, and all she'll want is iPhone or iPad. And even when you get like smashed up old iPhone off eBay, that's a smashed up one. I want the real one that's really online, that's really going to mess up your life if I dribble into it. So it is that they see. I don't know if it's the blue light that emits from these machines. I don't know, or they just know that that is the real world and that's the adult path into the world. She just seems to be attracted to this stuff, which is terrifying, because I'm like, yeah, my child's going to grow up only surrounded by Penguin classics and just bathing hummus every night. And she's already like, where's Kim Kardashian on my iPhone? I'm like, I want to kill myself in the bedroom. I suppose the solution is going to have to be a compromise. Like, you could wear